Great. I think we're all set. Welcome to the second session on the sea level change track. We have, again, a very distinguished panel here, which represents federal government, county, city governments, and a wide variety of projects that each one of these panelists could at any time talk to: flood control projects, habitat restoration, coastal development, as well as public access. I started putting out a little cheat sheet here, you know, after Ron had shown some of those numbers, and it's based on some of the work that we've been doing here in the Bay Area itself. And these are all sea level rise numbers, and the emphasis is more on the high end that I'm going to just read out here. Back in the 80s, 1987, National Research Council was asked that question, and the science was really not there. And so they looked at the science itself, and came up with three different scenarios: half a meter, 1 meter, 1.5 meter, and said, you know, these all are likely scenarios. EPA in 1995, again, started a study, and, you know, again, authored by some of the best minds, James Titus, who ultimately went on to be an IPCC author. They did a very nice study in 95, you know, which had as an upper range up to 34 inches of sea level rise by the year 2100. The third assessment report by IPCC, 35 inches. The California Climate Change Report, which Ron and Dan and others were a big part of, 31 inches. Professor Amstorf from Germany, you know, came up with these numbers, which were about 39, was an empirical science, about 40 inches, up to 55 inches, which is the 1.4 meters we hear of. 2007, the assessment report again, the fourth assessment report by IPCC, 23 inches, you know, about 2 feet. CalFed, 55 inches. Professor Hansen, or rather, Dr. Hansen at NASA, 5 meters, related to, you know, the Antarctic, the West Antarctic Shelf. Tad Pfeffer. The reason I'm bringing all this up is that, and the emphasis is not so much on these numbers and who is right, but these are all have been generated by some of the best minds in our field right now, all legitimate experts. You know, I'm an engineer, and some of the panelists here are also engineers, and we are used to dealing with design criteria and building codes and looking at the section number and coming up with the methodology that is stated in there. And every year our liability insurance provider comes in, educates us on, you know, well, what is indemnifiable and what is not. Looking at these numbers, the range of numbers, how do we respond to these numbers and design a structure where we are used to design lives? And we still obtain approvals from agencies. And with that, my ending thing really is, I think, what Trav was beginning to say, which is that the answer is not with the regulators. The answer has to come up as a consensus. It is a public policy process, and the answer has to come up from scientists as well as engineers as well as the stakeholders itself. And so without much further ado, Tom Kendall, Chief of Planning, San Francisco District Army Corps.
Okay, go to the next slide, please. So, yes, I work with Corps of Engineers. Our job is to supposedly make smart water resource investments, and we're doing that with a bunch of moving targets given the whole climate change discussion we're having. We did have some fairly recent guidance published this last summer. That engineering circular, I think, is in your compendium. It really is not that new of a policy. We've actually, as Dilip pointed out, there was an NRC publication in the late 80s that identified three scenarios that would be appropriate to consider. One hit a half a meter in the year 2100, another one hit a meter, and the highest hit a meter and a half. Shortly after that was published, the Corps said, well, we probably ought to do this, we probably ought to consider this. The problem was that that was really a departure from the preponderance of our guidance, which has us looking very much at a single most likely future against which we net project impacts to figure out if it's a good investment. One of the criticisms of the Corps over the years is that we have this sort of obsession with a singular benefit-cost ratio, which kind of works from a federal budgeting perspective, but is inherently flawed. So we've been talking for a while about doing a multi-scenario approach, but frankly, we don't have the tools, and it's not simple. But anyhow, it's been around, and what happened with the publication of this circular last summer, we kind of brought it into the limelight and said, we're going to have to do this. There's a lot of us involved with trying to make core guidance more consistent and to make this multi-scenario approach part of how we do business. Just quickly to the curves that we are asked to use, we've got the... What we did is we took these old curves, and when we published things again last July, we had to modify them a little bit because, you know, some time has elapsed. So they really still hit the same endpoints in the year 2100. The only thing is we played around with some of the coefficients to take into account what's happened in the last 30 years or so, as well as, you know, still make them fit the endpoint. So it's really just manipulation. So it's essentially the same curves that we've had for quite some time. But what we're saying now is we're gonna actually really use them in a multi-scenario approach, as opposed to, frankly, we had other guidance out there that said you should be still extrapolating off a historic. And so there was kind of some schizophrenic approaches being applied, frankly. So we're trying to get that all onto a common bit of guidance now, where we are going to go with this multi-scenario approach. The curves that we have that we're saying we should consider are this updated one of curve 3, which is the, I guess that's sort of a purple line there. We have an intermediate one, which is the old curve 1 from NRC. That's the one that hits about a half a meter. And again, I'm quoting you static figures. You've got to, you know, do your relative rise for your project. But the static rise would be roughly a half a meter. That's this curve here. And then the lowest thing to consider, and Ron mentioned this too, is that this is like your 0.2 meter by the year 2100 type rise. So those are the three that we're supposed to test all our projects against. The just shown for comparison here, here's the 20 and 55 inch figures and the B1A2 curves that show that our curves at least bracket those, okay? Doesn't mean they're good, but at least we bracket them. In a nutshell, that's what we're doing, but how are we going to do it? You know, what doesn't show up on this slide is this little area here should be blue, and it shows the typical 50-year planning horizon that the Corps uses. So what I'm trying to emphasize here is that our historic approach would be you'd see one line in this space that sort of describes how you expect a particular metric to evolve over your period of analysis. With this new paradigm we're talking about, you now have three lines, and we shouldn't really just look 50 years out. You know, we are in California, we're going to have to address CEQA, et cetera, and frankly, that's suggesting we're probably looking at least out to these 2100-year type values. So it's an approach that's historically been a single line in a little blue box here, now becoming multiple lines going way out to at least a century. So that severely complicates our life as planners. Where our guidance ultimately comes from is the principles and guidelines that have been around since the 80s, Water Resources Council. Those are now being updated, so that could have some ramifications. The Corps has historically been very biased by what's called national economic development, which is really the biggest bang for the buck. Discounting becomes a big issue in that. You know, if you're going to make an investment at year zero to protect you against a consequence at year 50, it better be a pretty bad consequence in year 50, because that year 50 consequence is going to be very discounted compared to the, you know, year zero investment point. So I think what we're probably going to see as the principles and guidelines get finalized, Council on Environmental Quality is working on those, is more emphasis on some of these other metrics. It's going to be less of a national economic development focus. And so I think the opportunity to argue for a federal investment in a resilient plan that will not go underwater in the future, for example, even though from a purely discounted economic perspective, that actually might be a very logical plan, if you consider the full suite of criteria, it might not be the most appropriate. And I think we're going to be able to get there. We can get there with the current principles and guidelines, but I think what often happens is if we want to recommend something that's not the biggest bang for the buck, our local sponsors tend to have to pay the increment. So that sponsor paying the additional increment is the aspect that I think may change as the new principles and guidelines are released. But anyhow, it gets back to resiliency. The other thing that Sam mentioned was the National Academy of Sciences or National Research Council effort. That contract, I guess, was just signed this week. This is in response to the governor's executive order, and then we've got the states of Oregon, Washington also participating in that, along with us, USGS, and NOAA. So our hope is that we can cite yet another NRC publication that's at least in this millennium as our source, and continue to update what are the curves we should be considering. But it all gets back to doing scenario planning, and that is not something we're accustomed to. What we're in effect doing is tripling our workload. We're going to go and analyze the benefits and costs for as if each of these scenarios were our reality, and then we're going to have to do some sort of assessment, and I think the term we're going to be hearing a lot is least regrets. If we were to over-adapt and build a whole lot of stuff at year zero to prepare us for, you know, the worst case scenario up here, and again, worst case is a relative term, I've heard 5 meters too, but currently our worst case is this one. If we were to, quote, over-adapt and spend a lot of money at year zero to prepare for that, how much regret would we feel if reality was down here? And likewise, as you can imagine, a matrix of you know, each scenario and the performance of each of your alternatives against each of those scenarios, and there'll be an assessment of what's going to cause the most regret. And it's relatively subjective. You know, again, Ron made the point, we don't have probabilities on these things. We're treating them each separately. There's almost an implicit equal weighting when you do that. You know, each scenario, if you actually discuss each of them, there's I think just the human nature is to think that they are equally probable, and that's not correct either. The point is we don't know. So it's a new paradigm, more challenging, and I think that's probably about all I should say for now. So we'll look forward to talking about it all.
Thank you, Tom. I'm sure we're going to have a lot of questions on multi-scenario planning. The next speaker, Mitch Avalon, Deputy Public Works Director at Contra County Public Works Department.
Well, thank you. You know, when people figure out what sea level rise is and the fact that they're going to get wet, who are they going to call, Ghostbusters? No, they're going to call the flood control districts. They're going to call us. And they're going to want to have their property protected because that's what they've expected in the past. Now, talking about a change of mindset, and we have to think outside the box, our customers, the public, is still going to want us to provide flood protection. About 5 years ago, all the flood control districts in the Bay Area formed the Bay Area Flood Protection Agencies Association so we can deal with these things on a collective basis. We're all different around the Bay Area. The one thing that is going to unite us is issues like sea level rise and trying to address those big topics. Talking about adaptation, I think the bad news is we have to adapt. The good news is we may have time to adapt. Hopefully, we'll have time to adapt. One of our fears as practitioners in trying to build things is that we will be forever adapting. And if we are planning a project and oftentimes just doing the feasibility study for a flood control project can take 10 years. And if we are constant, the science will evolve with time. And as the science evolves, we're going to suddenly say, well, there's some new information. We have to adapt again and adapt again. And our fear is we will never be able to get out of the feasibility stage, as we'll continually be chasing another standard for the project. Now, some can argue that natural systems are more resilient than a man-made structure like a concrete channel or a structure for a flood control protection. We have a policy, and a lot of other flood control districts in the Bay Area are looking to convert historical flood control channels to more of a natural system, more of a natural creek system. And we have a policy in Contra Costa County we call the 50-year plan, and it's so named because it's going to take a long time to see this vision of converting channels to natural creeks. But so a natural system may be more resilient. It takes a lot more room to put a natural system in place of a very efficient concrete channel, for example. So the natural system may be more resilient, but will the community surrounding it be as resilient? If we're going to redesign our flood control channels into more of a natural system and streams, we need to redesign our communities. And something that as flood control districts, or I look at as community design, that's not land use. And it's the result, community design results in land use, but the community design is a vision which drives land use in the general plan and down into the land use ordinances which implement general plan policies. So as a flood control district, we are involved with communities in providing a project, but it's really driven by the community desires. Some community may want to preserve their historic downtown. We talk about levels of protection, of 100-year level of protection. They may want to preserve their downtown and not have 100-year level protection, because that would mean wiping out a row of historic buildings. They may accept a 50-year level protection, and we have built projects for communities for less than 100-year protection. But suddenly, as we move forward, that level of protection is going to decrease as sea level rise becomes more evident. So our job as flood control districts, when we're going through this community design process, is inform them as best we can with all this, the changing information, that is the level of protection is going to change with time. This information has to be put forward so they can make the decisions today for their community tomorrow. And there may be a need to protect communities, as we mentioned in the past. For example, maybe some of the environmental justice communities around the Bay Area that we just can't move. So there will be a need for armoring. So don't throw all your old textbooks out just yet. We may still need to do some of this old engineering. Even back when we were hippies from Berkeley, like I was many years ago. I wasn't doing the tide gates, though, or tide tables. But the question is, how do we fund all this? I mean, where is all this money going to come from? This little chart I have here shows, at least in Contra Costa County, what the average household spends on what I call the three-legged stool of water. You have drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater. And when I talk about stormwater, I mean water quality, flood protection, stream habitat, stream restoration, stream stability. And for drinking water, we spend about $700 a year. For for wastewater, we spend over $300 a year. But in Contra Costa County, on our clean water, we have a $30 per parcel assessment. That's $30 we're investing a year. And in our best funded watershed for flood control, it's about $70. That's about $100 a year. So I will leave with a couple of questions. One is, do we spend enough money as a society on stormwater? And the second question is there really enough money to build our way out of the sea level rise? As an engineer, most engineers will tell you, if you want to build it, just tell me how we'll build anything. It's just a matter of how much money you have. Well, we may not have enough money to build ourselves out of this one. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mitch. Our next speaker, Ann Draper. Assistant Operating Officer with the Santa Clara Valley Water District.
Good morning. And when you see my one slide, you'll see that I violated slide etiquette. I had a variety of slides, and I decided to cram way too much onto one slide, but please bear with me. Santa Clara County is in the southern end of San Francisco Bay, and our sea is the bay. Now, why do I say that? It's because when I go around and talk to people about sea level rise sometime, they'll say, oh, I know all about sea level rise, but it really doesn't affect us because we're not on the ocean, we're on the bay. And I will say, yeah, but you know, it's all connected. And it's like this, oh, aha, oh, I didn't even think about that. So the level of knowledge, I really want to talk about knowledge, understanding, and then having an urge or a sense of need to go do something about it, because that's a real big continuum. So if you think that sea level rise doesn't even affect you because you're not on the ocean, then you may know about it, but you may not have understanding about it and thinking that you want to do anything about it. Our agency, the Santa Clara Valley Water District, has really two interests in relative to sea level rise. One is flood protection, as Mitch described, and the other is the restoration of the South Bay. We are in partnership with the Coastal Conservancy and others in the restoration project. And of course, sea level rise impacts both of these interests. As Mitch described, if we construct anything, we oftentimes need to have special voter-approved ballot measures to get the money to do the types of work that we want to do. What you may not know is we can do the first phase of the restoration of the bay in the South Bay without additional flood control measures, but after that, we essentially no more work can be done on that, or very little work can be done on that, until additional flood protection can be provided. So flood protection is really vital for the restoration of the South Bay. And so because we do need the voter initiative approvals, what you may not know, but some of you do, is that we need a two-thirds majority to get approval of these special measures. And that's a really high bar that we need to jump over, pass. And so we really need to move from understanding to knowing and having a sense of urgency to be able to get the funds to do projects that some people believe are really important. So last fall, we periodically poll voters to see what's of interest to them, what do they think that they might want to support. So last fall, we did one of our polls and engaged a expert polling agency to help us do this. And for the first time, we included a lot of questions about sea level rise and about levees to protect for sea level rise to understand what the order of priority for them this would be. And it came in dead last. I mean, it was it was in all the questions that were asked, it was at the bottom. Fresh water, mercury, taking mercury out of water was the highest. And our polling expert said if it's going to be for sea level rise alone, it just will not be supported by the voters. And so this was something that we needed to understand, that if we go forward, the reason that we go forward, the projects that we go forward with, whatever they may be, need to have resonance today with the voters, not something that may occur in the future because it will have the least support. I personally then went to each of the cities around the bay in my county to talk to them about a sea level rise. And I went just prior to some community meetings that BCDC was holding to try to actually encourage them to go to the BCDC meetings. And what I found, and I met with the planning directors or their planning staffs or in public works directors, is, well, I don't want to call it board indifference, but it was, they were polite when I got there. And they really weren't they were knowledgeable about it, but they really weren't too interested in it. And one city said yes, that they were including it in their general plan. One planning director said, wake me up when my feet get wet. And so that was the some of the dialogue. What did motivate them was the knowledge that FEMA was going to be redoing the elevation of the bay and that the insurance rate maps may change. And that really got them excited. But what we thought that we would be encountering the same type of reaction. And so we tried to create a game, which is what I have one shot on there, and that's the shortcut way of getting to it if you want to look at it. And so what it is the different sea level rises, and you can choose which one you want, and you can choose different risks, and then you can choose different ways of looking at what might be vulnerable. Because we wanted to raise this, you know, this curve from knowledge to understanding to doing something about it. And so that was our purpose for doing this. We also have a lot of information of reports. There must be 50 reports on different sea level rise models, and also about other things that talk about the benefits. So talking about the endangered species protection and some of those other issues, we have a lot of different information trying to appeal to the widest range of people that we can that might want to do something about sea level rise. What we've concluded is that where we need to start, and that's what we were talking about this morning, is start where cities and communities already feel a vulnerability. And in our area, that includes El Viso, which is part of San Jose, because it's already below sea level. And also, there's a water treatment plant, a sanitary treatment plant there. So they already know that in every scenario, they are vulnerable. The other area is Palo Alto, that also has the same type of infrastructure as well as community that's vulnerable in any scenario. What we think that we need to do is engage those two communities and perhaps another community that is high interest. Mountain View is interested in protecting its, protecting Google. They're interested, so we're not quite sure their risk is a little different. But engaging them and finding solutions that not only that we can protect what's very important to them, but also understand what may need to not be protected by flood protection. One of the things that the Mountain View planner said is that we need a better tool collectively to really understand these relative risks, and I know another speaker will be talking about this, to understand what's important to save, what maybe not, how do we make these decisions over time. But I think another part, and I think there was a question earlier as the other sort of emerging idea, is that we need to start with something that's credible and reasonable to the voters in the community today, but have enough width, if you would, so that as we learn more and adapt, we have the ability to adapt over time. Now, the other part is that probably going into the bay, it's going to be long and sloping because as opposed to a vertical wall. And the reason is because we want to be able to allow for the marshes and tidal areas and everything in the restoration to build up over time. And so we're going to need to really design, if you would, one side of the levee, if we're going to build levees, very differently than the other side of the levee so that we can allow for different types of adaptation depending on its orientation. So I wanted to let you know that we have started. We have started the dialogue with our community. We've tried to create a game, a way that we can have people, it's not really a game, but a way to have interaction to build the community's knowledge and sense that something needs to get done. So I'll leave that and move it to the next speakers.
Thank you, Ann. Moving right along to Michael Timoff with the Mayor's Office of Economic Development of the City of San Francisco.
Good morning. I too have to apologize for my slide etiquette. Well, one, you can't read this one. So why don't we go to my next one, which I was going to apologize for. I tried to sneak in two slides. So this morning I would like to, happy to be here, to share our approach to sea level rise and how we've proactively addressed it in the long-term planning for the redevelopment of Naval Station Treasure Island. Before I get into the specifics of our sea level rise approach, I would like to set the table, give you a little bit of background and context into the redevelopment planning process. We've been at this for about 15 years. Our office has been charged by the Treasure Island Development Authority with the pre-development planning and entitlements and negotiating a development agreement with our prospective master development partner, Treasure Island Community Development. In that 15 years, sea level rise has risen by about 1.2 inches. So if for no other reason than that, we need to get this project entitled and shovels in the ground. It's been a very extensive public process to get to where we are today. The public-private partnership that we have with Treasure Island Community Development not only enables the immense infrastructure requirements to be implemented, but it allows us to start from scratch and address sea level rise with the infrastructure planning that we're doing and building a new community out on Treasure Island. Today, Treasure Island is an existing community of about 2,500 residents. There's also commercial leases as well as a federal installation that's run by the Department of Labor's Job Corps campus. It's a job training facility. So not only is there an opportunity for an infill development with close proximity to major job centers in San Francisco Bay, but we have the opportunity to protect an existing community. So I think those two points about the island are very important as we move forward with addressing sea level rise. The development program is, we're looking at in our EIR, up to 8,000 new residential units, 100,000 square feet of office, approximately 140,000 square feet of new retail, and 300,000 square feet of adaptive reuse of existing historic structures. So what are we doing to address sea level rise? The approach that we've taken is a two-pronged approach. It is both the initial improvements that will be made as part of the redevelopment project, and then has been talked about today, an adaptive management strategy that will play out over the long term. So I'll talk about the first piece. We've been working with Moffitt and Nickel and a team of engineers and planners, as well as our regulatory partners, both at the local level, the regional, and the state level, to develop these strategies. We've looked at the extensive literature that exists on sea level rise estimates and the policy guidance. I think it is important to note that this is a dynamic and shifting landscape in terms of policy. When we started, this was not really even in, well, it was not in the plans, and public policy discussions were few and far between about sea level rise. So had this project been entitled 10 years ago, addressing sea level rise within the context of the redevelopment plan would not have taken place. There has been, at the local level, again, little guidance. We are working with the PUC and DPW right now to perfect this strategy. We have adopted CalFed and BCDC's design allowance recommendations of 16 inches by 2050 and 55 inches by 2010. So what that entails, what that will look like on the ground, and I apologize, I don't have a site plan to give this a visual context, but what that looks like is we will be raising the grades for the entire development area. That includes the new development pads for buildings, the surrounding streets, and infrastructure 36 inches above the base flood elevation, or today's 100-year high tide. And then the finished floor elevations of the buildings themselves will have an additional 6 inches of freeboard, so 42 inches above the 100-year high tide line. At the shoreline edge, and that development area is approximately 100 acres of the 400 acres on Treasure Island. Along the shoreline edge, we'll elevate or be setting the elevations to protect from wave overtopping. Those elevations will be set to accommodate up to a 16-inch rise in sea level before additional improvements would need to be made. Those additional improvements would consist of both storm drain pumps as well as raising the berm as sea level continues to rise. Another important thing to note, in working with BCDC and the Treasure Island Development Authority, when the lands are conveyed from the Navy to TIDA, will be acting as the long-term trustee of the public lands. All of Treasure Island will be subject to the State Lands Commission's public trust doctrine. We're working on perfecting an exchange agreement to lift those encumbrances off of approximately 100 acres on Treasure Island to Yerba Buena Island, but for all of the remaining areas on Treasure Island, title will be the trustee and those lands will remain permanently in the public trust. So in working with the mandates of BCDC and the public trust to maximize public access to the waterfront and promote such uses as recreation and wildlife habitat creation and restoration, we're trying to balance the need for protecting an existing community, protecting future infrastructure improvements with the need to and the desire to get people out to the water's edge. So the improvements along the shoreline are being made to promote maximum feasible public access while at the same time allowing future improvements to be made by increasing the height of the berm in some locations. We'll also be looking in other areas where we have larger setbacks to actually lay back the shoreline and design engineered tidal beaches and introduce tidal wetlands. And then in other locations where a setback is less, we'll be looking at seawall types of applications. So I've described a little bit the types of future improvements that will be made, the what, and then the how. As this plays out over time, because we haven't hung our hat on any one number or any one time frame, we're going to use a monitoring program in place to actually make measurements and make a determination relative to the frequency and duration of storm events and wave overtopping to decide at what point in time we make those future improvements, and then also creating a project-generated funding mechanism that would allow those improvements to be made over time. We're thinking about two different mechanisms to do that. One would be reassessing the Community Facilities District assessment on future property owners once the initial infrastructure bonds are retired. The other would be creating a geologic hazard abatement district, which would be another assessment acting essentially as a rainy day fund to make those improvements in the future. So I guess the take-home point would be our adaptive management strategy is really a three-part approach of if you have the time, which we do, we don't know when sea level rise is going to occur and at what rate. If you have the space, in this case the development setbacks of between 200 and 350 feet, you can accommodate those future improvements. And if you have the money, you can address sea level rise in a variety of ways that are site-specific and respond to real-time conditions. So with that, I will end.
Thanks, Michael. And our last speaker, Jeremy Lowe, Phil Williams & Associates.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to tell you about a study that we've been doing for the Hayward Area Shoreline Protection Planning Agency. Could I have the slide, please? This is a JPA made out of the City of Hayward, the Hayward Area Recreation District, and the East Bay Park Recreation District. And the study was to look at about 4 miles of the East Bay from the San Mateo Bridge up to the San Leandro Creek, which is shown in the aerial photograph we have there. And their main question was sea level rise. We hear about it all the time in the media. We have some responsibilities on the shoreline. What does it mean to us? So we started at the first point and said, well, how much sea level rise is it going to be? And we heard that question asked, what do we use for the sea level rise scenarios? So we sort of copped out a bit and we said, well, we use the state numbers. We use the 16 inches by the middle of the century, the 55 inches by the end of the century. And we didn't have fancy Google. We didn't have Google to provide fancy graphics for us. So we visualized it by saying, by the middle of the century, it's going to come up to your knee. And by the end of the century, 55 inches is going to be up to here on your chest. And if you do that, you plot that out on the Hayward shoreline, This is a large amount of reclaimed marshes. A large amount of that area is inundated. And in that area, there are a large number of functions. We've got two water treatment plants at Oro Loma and at the city of Hayward. We have stormwater channels. We have a couple of landfills. We have running through the area, we have the EBDA pipeline taking wastewater, treated wastewater all the way out to a long sea outfall in Oakland. We have the Bay Trail. We have PG&E. There's a whole number of different uses of this area which are likely to be affected by sea level rise. So in our initial study, we looked at the vulnerability of those functions. What would be the impact of sea level on those on the operation of those areas? We also came up with a number of strategies. We looked at the potential for holding the line, maintaining the existing levee line, building it up, making it higher, making it stronger, making it wider. The implications of that on the shoreline, on the natural habitat. We looked at moving that defense line all the way back to Hayward, giving the area of the restoring marshes, restoring the ability of those marshes to attenuate the waves, to lower the impacts of sea level rise. And we looked at the opportunities that we had in this area. There's a large amount of sediment trapped in stormwater channels in this area. There's other structures, such as marinas, which are trapping material. We looked at the movement of treated water, relatively fresh water, moving through the system. It's now moving in pipes underneath the marshes out to the outfalls. It's now being treated in the wastewater treatment plants. In the past, this sediment and this water was being diffused and passed onto the marshes and allowing them to grow and to maintain their position with sea level rise. So we started looking at other ways to adapt this shoreline. Are there ways in which we can accommodate the uncertainty in the projections of the sea level rise by adding sediment, by adding brackish marshes, which rise more quickly with sea level rise, to a long-term vision for this shoreline. So we didn't come up. This is a very preliminary point, and we just wanted to give ideas out to people. And you can read all about them in our report, which is actually on the discs that were handed out as part of this talk. But I wanted to really talk to you about what the next steps are that we're doing for the Hayward shoreline. Now, the advantage of I'll probably start with the last point at the bottom there, which is the Joint Powers Authority. The fact that you have a group of people who are interested in this shoreline, and they have been for the last 30 years, they have been doing protection and restoration of the marshes for the last 30 years along here, it means you had a natural talking shop when the question about what do we do with sea level rise came up. Now, there were three members of that group. It doesn't cover all the public and private entities in that area. But now they're trying to do outreach to those groups. They're trying to do outreach to the wastewater treatment facilities, to EBDA, who control the pipeline, to the flood control, to the landfills. So we're starting to get an idea, a group of people together who are interested in the long-term management of this shoreline. Our first step, though, is to look at a vulnerability assessment. We've looked at the functions, but now we want to look at the facilities. What are the different plants, the pipelines, actually vulnerable to? And there's three steps to that. Firstly, we're going to look at the damage modes. What levels of impact are going to be the wastewater treatment is vulnerable to? Is it rising sea level? Is it inundation? Is it erosion? Is it groundwater levels? What are the landfills vulnerable to? So working with the operators, working with the people who know how those systems work, we're trying to understand what damage can be caused. Then we want to look at the risk. What are the risks of the of the inundation reaching that level? We've heard earlier on about the uncertainties associated with sea level rise, but also the uncertainties involved in other areas such as the amount of the wind changes, the storminess, El Ninos. So we need to understand how the risk of those to damage, and also what the severity of that damage will be. Will it just things just get wet, or will they be damaged and not functioning? And the idea there from this work is to get a prioritized list of what is really vulnerable on that shoreline, and we're going to prioritize it in terms of time. What's vulnerable, and when's it going to be vulnerable? And we're also asking people about the lead time. How long does it take to get the planning in place? Replacing a wastewater treatment plant or or moving it takes an awful long time. So what's the lead time that we need to start thinking? Can we get these ideas into the planning process early on? And the main aim here is to inform the capital improvement plans and the operation and management plans of these facilities. Moving on, we're looking to create a master plan, a long-term vision for this area. It'd have to include interim management. This is long-term processes that we're talking about and how to change land uses in certain cases. But we still need to protect those in the interim. We need to long-term range planning. We need to look at 100 years because some of these facilities have that type of planning cycle. We need to also start thinking about experiments, demonstrating what ideas that may or may not work. Can we make use of some of the existing marshes down here that we have in the south, which are freshwater marshes, understanding how they operate? Can we understand how they would operate in the future? We need to think about the environmental requirements and the potential funding sources and the permitting. All these are sort of separate tracks that we're having as part of the ongoing studies. But the main point of this is that Hayward have started to think about this relatively early on, and they started to understand what the potential impacts are going to be here. And so my main take-home message from our work so far is that the planning that they're doing, it needs to be informed by the physical processes. It needs to be informed by an understanding of how the sea level may occur and how the shoreline may naturally respond. And so we need to think about it in the regional context. They're thinking they may have to extend their area of interest because it naturally fits in with the natural processes that are occurring in the bay. They need to think about an extended time horizon, not to plan exactly what's going to happen in 50 or 100 years' time, but to think about what if certain sea level rise scenarios actually occur, will they be able to adapt? Will they be able to accommodate those changes? They're thinking about change. They're understanding that the shore, the salt marshes, the mudflats will change regardless of what we plan and what we say they will do. And they need to accommodate that change. And most of all, they need to understand that they're accommodating the uncertainty. As has been pointed out before, the 16 inches isn't necessarily going to happen in 2050. It may happen a decade before, a decade later. And what part of this process is to build up a process where we have a group which will stay together in the long term to manage that and accommodate that uncertainty. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. A round of applause for all the speakers so far. We're opening this up to question and answers. Given the time, I was thinking perhaps it may be a good idea to perhaps just have both the panels be open to questions itself. We're moving right into that time frame itself. Let me just get a hand here. I'd like to start off with a question just because I have. Can you hear me? Yeah. It is. Okay. Is it fair to say that, to summarize both panels itself, would it be fair to say that, and this is a two-part question, that acceptable levels of risk need to be developed and that planning horizons, which I heard the word, in a couple of speakers, but planning horizons need to be understood through the education process with the public itself, coming up with adaptation strategies itself. And then the real question, how can these adaptive management strategies be developed in a manner which, still is not perceived as defensive engineering at one end of the spectrum, or just kicking the can down the road at the other end of the spectrum?
Well, for part of that, I think in terms of planning horizons, I think it's twofold. One is for planning land use, like general plan planning, which usually has a 20-year planning horizon, I think maybe we need to shorten that so that we're looking at, you know, policies and our practices for land use on a more shorter basis, maybe 10 years. But then the planning horizon for projects that are going to respond to or to be adaptable, we have to look even longer, like 50 years or beyond that. So I think the planning horizon we need to look at from different perspective, shorten them in some regards and lengthen them in other regards.
Before coming to the Water District, I was a planning director at Cities and Santa Clara County. And I'd say in the planning area, the local jurisdictions guard their ability to plan with great tenacity. And so they are the ones who want to make these decisions. And in my conversations with them, understanding different levels of risk and being able to have tools to help them make decisions came up. Because they think it's now just sort of all or nothing. But they also hear that, you know, we're going to have to decide what do we want to save. And treatment plants, usually you get agreement on that. But when you talk about parks or golf courses or some of those other things that are around the bay, it's always not as clear as to what should be saved. So I'd say providing tools to help people understand the relative risks are important. The other thing is most of the land use laws require that the level of knowledge about the risk be reasonably predictable. So when we start talking about scenarios, they'll say that's way too iffy for us to do anything in land use. So there may be some need for change in law that talk about the lesser degree of certainty if, in fact, there are other regulatory agencies which will want to push the land use agencies into an area that they will be concerned that they will be subject to takings. So there's a lot of different regulatory changes that may need to evolve.
And that's exactly the reason why the next step after the initial preliminary study was to do a vulnerability assessment to try and get that prioritized list of what was really at risk. And to so that we understand which areas need to be defended first. But in the longer term, there's a realization that some of those facilities and some of those uses may have to be actually moved out of the area. But to get that discussion in early into the planning cycle was important, because we understand that they already have, some of these areas already have plans to do things, but they didn't have necessarily understood what the implications of leaving in the same place with sea level rise. So now we've inserted that discussion into their planning. I don't necessarily think it's going to cost them extra. It may, their plans just may change, and I think that's something that we by promoting the ideas about sea level rise and also promoting its uncertainty, you can get those things into the planning cycle relatively early on.
I don't know if it's speaking directly to your question, but one of the challenges has often been that the Corps has limited the amount of adaptive management and monitoring it will put in its projects. And that's really a policy-driven thing. Individual projects, when they get authorized, can have much larger amounts. And the most recent Water Resources Development Act actually expanded the duration that we are to do adaptive management and monitoring to at least 10 years, which I know in the scale of this is still short, but it's a step in the right direction. And what I see with federal decision documents is going to be a move towards a phased investment. You know, we would show that making this investment in year zero makes sense if we, say, assume a worst-case scenario with our sea levels. If we're then to come in year 20 or whatever and make a subsequent investment. In other words, you might acquire additional real estate, for example, to not have inappropriate encroachment going on adjacent to your project during those 20 years. So you might make that investment up front predicated on an assumption that you're going to have to expand things or do some setbacks in year 20. But bundle that together as a phased investment package, not one that just says, here's what we're going to do now and somehow we'll do something in the future, but actually spell out what that future would look like. Obviously, there's an opportunity to revisit that subsequent investment decision as you get closer to it, but having that defined up front in the original decision document, I think, will be helpful.
Well, I'd like to ask Scott also to come up here and just field the questions. And, you know, this is an open dialogue process now. It's not so formal Q&A. If you've got questions, if you've got comments on the earlier presentations or the other panel members have comments on, you know, on these talks, you know, it's completely open. Phil?
Thanks, Dilip. Really great couple of panels here. And I just had a couple of thoughts. The first thing that struck me was Will's invitation to think out of the box. So, Will, you asked for it. And I kind of listening to all the aspects of these discussions, I felt there were like three key components, a couple of which are problems that we're struggling with, how to deal with this big picture. And the first aspect I think all of you are pretty well involved in that are on the panels, and that is on the ground, knowing the local area, knowing the projects and the site-specific aspects of what you're dealing with. And I think the existing structures that we have are reasonably adequate to address those. And then the second problem that I heard is the uncertainty and the uncertainties. And so one level of uncertainty perhaps can be dealt with in a more or less immediate basis, but the uncertainty and the uncertainties is a little bit more difficult to deal with. And what I would suggest is that keying in on Tom's curves of those different sea level scenarios, I was thinking that basically these represent different components of risk. And of course, despite what Reinhardt said, we can't evaluate the risk, but that's never really stood in the way of risk evaluators in the past. They can always come up with something. And I think what might be considered is to look at those different levels as some risk framework. Take your projects, plan them, design them, permit them, and build them, and assign those projects a level of risk that's been addressed and a level of residual risk. And you can do that any way you want. And you could do it on a site-specific basis. So then you have a project that has a level of risk that's been addressed to some standard. That project also has a level of residual risk, and there may be some uncertainty about what that residual risk is. So now you have at least something to go on. But then you have the problem of, well, how do you address that residual risk? But in the context of sea level rise, it's residual risk that perhaps is more informed as time goes on. So over time, potentially, you have a way of addressing residual risk. So one possible way of addressing this would be to issue financial instruments. And the financial instruments, perhaps somewhat analogous to a bond, is based on a level of risk that is more certain and a level of risk that's less certain. And then the third component of this is how do you address that over time. And I would suggest to you, despite the last couple of years' experience, that there may be a way of addressing this in a market arena, where you take now these financial instruments that have, at the time they were issued, two components of risk, put those out in the marketplace, and then let the market adjust those financial instruments based on what happens over time, and let those instruments and that market then take care of how the residual risk is addressed. So that's just a couple of thoughts. Thanks.
That sounds like something for Ed.
Any comments, responses to that? Or I guess I can follow up, and maybe this is, again, this is a question to perhaps, I wouldn't say regulators as much as city planners and county planners, you know, which is how do you incorporate risk into a plan such that a repeat of things like Pacifica and everything that we see on TV about homes falling off, that was also approved, it was part of the city plan documents itself. And how do you incorporate that risk into a levee height in Santa Clara, for example, where 30 years down the road, you know, oops, we were short, but they're still approved projects.
How to? Basic city planning or any type of land use planning is about balancing risk. And so I'll use geologic risk as an example. We have the cities and the county have maps from the state that talk about different levels of risk for different types of geologic risk, landslides, earthquakes, and liquefaction. And so based on that information, the cities and the counties need to talk about their land use regulation to minimize risk. Fire risk is another risk that is taken into consideration, wildland fires, those types of things. So this is essentially just another risk. And but they'll need to have a starting place that they'll say, which is what we've talked about, what is a reasonable place to start, that there is consensus around that. And I think that that will be what people will start to take into consideration. And then as, and so the levee height or whatever, or the place that we will say, no, this is going to just go back to nature, so to speak, will need to be reviewed at the local level using those tools to say what's to keep, what's to save, how high is the levee to start with. And then there'll need to be monitoring or other types of things periodically to say, as I think Mitch said, part of the discussion will also need to be, just because you have some safety now doesn't mean that you're going to have it in 10 years, 15 years. And that part, that dialogue is going to be very different for a lot of communities.
And I think one thing we have to think about is how do we communicate this to the public? And from a flood control perspective, most people are used to levels of protection. The 100-year storm is something that they've kind of in minds of most people because it's tied to the flood insurance. But we can look at the recurrence interval or the frequency of which they get wet. As I think, Ann, you mentioned, the one planning director said, well, wait, we want to get wet. Well, we can look at these various scenarios of 16 inches or 55 inches and lay a map on a community and say, in this community, in this portion here, you're going to get wet every, you know, 2 years, whereas now you only get wet once every 50 years. So that kind of thing, I think, resonates with people. So we have to think about how we communicate this.
The reason I pointed in the front here, because that does sound like it's a flood mapping issue in FEMA and other agencies. And is this part of the decision-making process that goes into how you're looking at redrawing maps or some of the other processes today and also in the future?
I guess I'd answer that for right now, no. That there's not a component, get out of the light there, not a a direct outcome from the study that I talked about earlier that I think would directly impact flood mapping at this point. We're still very much committed to looking at current conditions. I think guidance that comes out of these studies about methodologies that we use to look at, and particularly when we look at probability and bounding and on our statistics that we use for flood mapping, those tools could come out of these studies and be something that we would consider implementing in the future. I guess I would caution, you know, that you know, beyond flood mapping, when we talk about levees and flood protection measures and that sort of thing, you know, we've been involved as an agency in a nationwide effort to reevaluate and recertify or request recertification information for existing levees. We don't expect that is a one-time event. So we would expect that on some recurring interval. It hasn't been officially, I don't think, established, but I think we're working hand in hand, I think, with the Corps on determining what that interval should be, but that say, 20 years or maybe on a more frequent basis, we would request similar recertification information from communities. And if sea level rise and climate change have had an impact on flood elevations, levees that might have been able to be certified and under current conditions to protect to the 100-year level, that might not be true in the future. So I would certainly say looking forward, particularly for new flood control measures or what have you, that there definitely needs to be consideration of climate change, sea level rise, and some of the same information. So maybe the methodologies that are coming from our studies are something we want to look at and promote for investigation or development of certification guidance in the future.
Thanks. I'm going to ask both Sam and Trav actually to comment on, you know, the restoration side. You know, we've been focusing on the flood control side. You know, our standard practice right now for restoring marshes is, you know, we shoot for high tidal marsh and invest millions of dollars into getting dredge material sediment in, pumping it across, you know, miles. What if it's too low? Well, we know it's going to be low in a few years.
First of all, Sam and I are in absolute agreement we ought to turn this over to the international financial community to make the decisions. Because once we tell them what the risks are, the Chinese aren't going to put any more money into this, so we aren't going to have to worry about design and planning and engineering because nobody can finance it. That means we're going to have lots of opportunities for wetland restoration, and Sam can tell you how that works.
Yeah, so that's actually not the standard practice. The way we're doing it at Hamilton is turning out to be quite expensive, and I doubt that we'll be interested in doing that again in the future. Wetland projects that we design now are designed to adapt to fairly robust rises in sea level, and it also turns out that tidal wetlands sequester carbon, so we get at least a twofer, and hopefully we'll be able to get some offset money there eventually. I mean, I think that the deeper problem is that outside of the Bay Area, we have situations where there is no retreat possible. I mean, in the Bay Area, we have wetlands that are big enough and that, you know, that we can let them move over time, and that's really the only place in California, I think, where that's the case.
My question, pretty much for the whole panel, given all the discussion, science, information over the recent years about sea level rise and the whole matter, I was particularly surprised by Anne's comment that the public viewed it as, you know, sounded distantly last as an issue of their concern. So with all these desires and intents and possible regulations to address sea level rise, I'm sure agencies like, you know, Mitch's and Ann's, when you go to do something to address this, you have to most likely have special bond initiatives or something like that to raise funding. How do you overcome the public disinterest in this subject if you're ever going to try and address this matter?
Jerry Brown once described political leadership as figuring out where the public was going, getting out in front of them and saying, follow me. I think the challenge we have is we take polls in the morning to decide where we should go in the afternoon. And while that information is very valuable, I think our toughest job as professionals is to take a problem that we analytically have looked into the future and said, here is a problem which is going to be a crisis in the future, and to drag that crisis back into the present and get the public and elected officials who are trying to kick it off to the next person, and the public is, we're telling them, look, you really ought to reduce trans fats in your diet. You can't afford the mortgage in your house. The transmission on your Buick sounds lousy. and we really want you to worry about sea level rise in the future. Because if you don't worry about it now, it will be a crisis, and all those other things are going to be irrelevant to you. So I think we as professionals have a challenge there that is probably the greatest one that we face. It's not dealing with the uncertainties. It's taking that problem and bringing it back to the public now so that they can understand it.
And I would say that I would agree that there's bringing it back so they can understand, but also look at all the other benefits and all the other partners that you might have, and you have to start somewhere. So find out where you have the most receptive partners, and also look at whether people get excited about restoring the bay. Those are partners. If they're excited about saving their sanitary treatment plant so they can flush their toilets, those are partners. You know, you have to look at who are your partners in a really different way and start there, and which is different from where we may have in the past.
The other thing is, I think, you know, some of these things take a long time to get through, but we have to start talking about it. The more you start talking about it, at some point down the road, it starts to click. And I like to think about, you know, when I'm presenting before a city council, talking about some project, for example, I always talk about our 50-year plan. I've been doing this for almost 10 years now, and I've got some cities that are interested in talk about it. When I first started, you know, you're talking to political or elected officials on a four-year cycle, and they don't want to think 50 years out and take the heat for something that's going to happen, you know, sometime later. But the more you talk about it, then they start talking about it too. So, I mean, I think we just got to start talking it up. Because they know a little bit about it, but they don't know enough about it. So the more we talk about bringing them the data and information that we have, you'll get some more acceptance.
Well, thank you. I think we'll take one question. Ellis?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Ellis Wallenberg with Kennedy Jenks Engineers. Would our good friend from the city address the geotechnical stability of Treasure Island?
So talk about risk. I meant to address this as part of our initial improvements. So in addition to raising the grades of the development areas, we're going to undertake a series of ground improvements, the first of which is called deep dynamic compaction. It's essentially dropping a large weight from a great height repeatedly to take out the risk of liquefaction of the unconsolidated sand, the fill that was used to create the island. That overlays a thicker layer of young bay mud. So after the deep dynamic compaction operation is done, we'll do a rolling surcharge program to consolidate the young bay mud, which only responds apparently to Dillip and others, to a static. This is getting out way beyond my knowledge base here, so forgive me. So it's a two-part operation of consolidating the underlying fills, and then there will also be a series of perimeter improvements through vibro-compaction in some areas, and as I mentioned, we'll be raising the grades in some areas as well. So the idea is creating a long-term stable platform for the building development.
That's very well addressed, Michael. you know, there's going to be a lot of opportunity for questions at the lunch program itself. So I'd encourage you to, you know, I guess we have about 15 minutes to, about 10 minutes to go over to the lunch room. And it's in the Jewel, it's right next door. Yeah.